Welcome. So I want to welcome everyone to the second installment of the Research Learning Series, which is put on by our ASEP research subcommittee within the ultrasound section. I'd like to welcome our panelists, and today's topic is going to be breaking down study designs. We're going to go over pros, cons, and common flaws. I'm going to start by letting each of our panelists introduce themselves. So why don't we first start with Felipe Turan, if you'd like to go first.
Sure. Welcome, everybody. I'm Felipe Turan. I'm an emergency physician and researcher. I work at Cornell, Weill Cornell Medicine in New York, and where I started only a couple months ago. And I, at this point, actually, I'm 50-50 research and clinical. And I do research primarily in cardiac arrest. As I've, I think, explained in previous webinars, I've see myself as a cardiac arrest researcher rather than an ultrasound researcher. And ultrasound happens to be part of my research or part of my work. But more broadly, I'm interested in resuscitation and cardiac arrest as a disease. And I've come to apply or to study specifically the use of ultrasound in that particular setting and patient population.
Thanks, Felipe, for joining us. Next up on my screen, I have Keith Boniface, if he'd like to go ahead and introduce himself.
Sure. Hi, I'm Keith Boniface. I'm from George Washington and in Washington, D.C. And I would view myself as not a natural researcher. I think I was invited onto this panel because Mike Gottlieb sends a lot of reviews my way. And so I'll talk a little bit about reviewing as a way to learn more about research and a little later. But I started out as an accidental researcher trying to grow this specialty of emergency ultrasound, and I feel like I'm still a clinician educator first. But I think I've had a lot of good mentorship that's helped me do some good research, and hoping to pass some of my bad experiences on to you so you can avoid those.
Thanks very much. Next, I'd like to pass it off to Dr. Megan Leo.
Thanks. So I'm Dr. Megan Leo. I'm at Boston University Medical Center in Boston. And I'm currently the vice chair of emergency ultrasound. Also, you know, kind of view myself more as a clinician researcher than, very well-seasoned researcher. I spent a lot of my academic time teaching and also, focused on building curriculum and also kind of competency research has sort of been more of my focus. And I'm happy to be here. So thank you.
And last but not least, if Dr. Michael Pratz would like to go ahead and introduce himself.
Hey everybody, I'm Mike Pratz. I'm at The Ohio State University in Columbus. And I am also kind of view myself more of an educator, and I come at research from the educational standpoint where I'm thinking like, how can we teach this better or how can we learn this better? And I also do with some of my friends run the Ultrasound Jail podcast. So we're definitely reading through lots and lots of articles and lots of studies. And from that standpoint, I really love digging into and analyzing strengths and weaknesses of specifically ultrasound research and the wild world that it is.
Thanks very much for joining us. So in order to start today, what we thought we'd do is give a brief overview of some of the most common study designs used in point of care ultrasound research. What we're going to do is have Mike Pratz go over cross-sectional studies, and then Keith will go over our case control studies, and Dr. Leo or Meg Leo will go over the prospective cohort design. And then lastly, Felipe is going to go over the what an RCT is. And then we're going to jump into sort of some of the questions. Now, through the webinar, I really want to engage our attendees to be able to put questions into the chat. So if there's questions particularly that you have about your work or about study designs or trying to get some advice, I encourage you to type in, and we'll try and get to those and feed those in. And I may hold some of the questions to put them in with another question that may be coming up later, but please go ahead and put them in early or as they come up as we're talking. So I'm going to pass it off to Mike first, and then we'll go through those study designs.
There's a couple of quick things I want to bring up before I even get into the cross-sectional stuff. The first is that when we're thinking about the types of study design, really the way that you can frame it to yourself is trying to establish causality. How well does the design link one thing to another thing, whether it be an intervention or how accurate something is? And so a lot of the study designs will dance around different ways to tackle that question. There's also a big distinction between a diagnostic test like ultrasound, most commonly is, and a therapeutic or a treatment modality. And a lot of the designs will differ even within the same general classification in whether you're doing something that's supposed to be treating the patient or something that you're doing to diagnose or test. So bear those things in mind too. Now, the cross-sectional study is a type of observational study. That means that we're not actually doing anything to people. We're observing, we're watching to see what's going on and what sort of information can we gain from a certain group. So cross-sectional, just like it sounds, it's like if you picture the whole population as like a big tube, you're taking a slice of it, you're just taking a cross-section out and you're looking at the distribution of variables in that population. So you can see how much of one thing certain people have or how much another group has. And then you try to draw conclusions from those things. So obviously it's fast because you don't have to wait over time to try to gather data. But the disadvantage is that you can't really get everything in one snapshot of time. You may miss rare outcomes, but it can be a stepping stone to doing other studies. So for example, there's a great study that came out pretty recently that just, it was called Assessment of Acute Obstetrical Needs and the Potential Utility of Point-of-Care Ultrasound in Haiti. And what they did was they just looked at all these patients coming in for obstetric complaints and how many of those people would an ultrasound help them. So that's just a snapshot in time, this one group, how often would ultrasound be useful? It doesn't establish that ultrasound is going to be useful. It's theoretical, but it's collecting data, and that can be a very effective study design.
Thanks. Keith, do you want to go up next?
Sure. I'm going to put an article link in the chat for everyone, just so they can see what I'm looking at. So I'm going to talk about case control studies, which is another type of observational study where we're not assigning an intervention, we're just watching what happens. But these are retrospective studies. So they start by identifying the cases, people with the disease that you're interested in looking at, and getting a collection of these cases. And then you compare them to a group of controls that do not have the disease. And you look backward to identify factors that can predict disease. And I think classically, these are done like the big, you know, back in the 1950s, these were big studies looking at smoking and lung cancer, and they're great for finding multiple etiologies of relatively rare things. From radiology and ultrasound standpoint, it's really looking for things, predictive ultrasound features that can predict disease, and it's useful for things that are somewhat less common. Because you don't need to amass as many patients in order to prove your result. And before I kind of talk about the Gavin Boudram article, which I think is a great example of a well-done case control study, I'm going to put a pin in a warning about case control studies, because they're kind of famous in the diagnostic literature for maybe kind of over representing the accuracy of the diagnostic test being studied. You see this with a lot of AI research in radiology. And what happens is you can kind of cherry pick your cases to be the classic cases, and you can cherry pick your controls to be kind of not very representative. And what this case control study by Boudram and Schoenfeld did was they took a bunch of people, bunch of women presenting to their center over 14 years, every person presenting over to their institution over 14 years who had a radiology ultrasound to evaluate for ovarian torsion. They took all the cases of torsion that they found, 92, matched them with 92 cases of torsion, and looked for predictive features of mean ovarian diameter to assess for its predictive ability. And I think they avoided some of these pitfalls by having not picking and choosing their cases, but including all of their cases. And so I think that's one of the ways they avoided that kind of common bias. And then the other way people screw around with these studies to kind of fool the reader is they cherry pick the controls. So they're not people where you're even considering the diagnosis, really. So that's why they chose people who are getting the study to rule out torsion, and they matched people with it by age with the cases. So I thought that was a well done study. So I think making sure you pick good control, good cases, and not cherry pick them. Pick good controls that are representative of people who don't have the disease, but you're considering it. And then the last thing is kind of avoiding bias as you're kind of trying to track down these findings, and blinding, I think, is something we'll probably circle back to later in this discussion as far as the foundation of a good diagnostic test study, blinding and data collection forms and things like that.
So. Next up, Meg.
So I'm going to cover prospective cohort studies. So as opposed to looking back in time, these are longitudinal studies that chooses a group of individuals that have similar characteristics and have predetermined factors that you are going to measure over time. So this kind of study often helps research determine etiology diseases or disorders. It's also a way for investigators to answer questions about associations between risk factors and disease outcomes. And typically, prospective cohort studies are seen as you know, ranked somewhat higher than some of these retrospective studies because you're choosing patients based on predetermined factors and then just watching them over time. So there's less opportunity for bias in that way.
Thanks, Meg. And then lastly, Felipe, if you want to go over RCTs.
Yeah. So RCTs are, to some extent, the easiest and the most complex, I would say, from the perspective of point-of-care ultrasound, we could say that it's unfortunately the minority of studies, and actually overall in any field, probably for that matter, it's the least common studies. RCT specifically refers to randomized control trial, and that is essentially we're randomly selecting a group of patients or individuals to receive a specific treatment, and then another group of patients or individuals to receive another type of treatment, specifically a placebo. And within the definition, the broader definition of clinical trials, which is the broader term, randomized controlled trial, RCT, is one very specific one and often described as sort of the holy grail of all research studies in terms of its quality. Above it, if you will, in terms of the strength of the conclusions and this sort of spectrum that we just described, that would start with, I guess, case reports or case series that we didn't actually describe, but immediately after that, it would be case controls or cross-sectional studies. Then in that spectrum and the end of the spectrum, it would be systematic reviews and meta-analyses, which are actually fairly common in the, or a lot more common in the emergency ultrasound literature. And right under that is the randomized control trial. So generally speaking, the systematic reviews and meta-analyses are the top tier, or the best available evidence when there is good quality of studies to review and meta-analyze. As many of you have probably experienced, a problem in the emergency ultrasound or point-of-care ultrasound literature is that often when we do systematic reviews, I was just involved in one this year. You have the intention to do a meta-analysis, which is what really gives you that extra strength. You're analyzing the data of other studies and then coming drawing conclusions from those sub-studies. The problem in Pornokil design very often is that you do the systematic review part, but then once you get to the part of meta-analyzing, you realize that because there's just simply not enough high-quality studies, i.e. randomized controlled studies, or even just clinical trials, interventional studies, then you can't do that meta-analysis if you don't have enough of those. So from that perspective, randomized controlled trials, not only are they minority, but also to some extent are also the most complex. They're the most research resource intensive. They're the most costly to some extent. And for those, for all those reasons, they're often not the first study that anybody will be involved with. There are multiple subtype of research, of clinical trials, of subtype of clinical trials. When we say trial as part of that definition, we're referring to an intervention. So something important to highlight perhaps, because I do remember that within the point of culture literature, there are often large studies that have been done are referred as trials just because they're very large. A good example, I think, is the Reason study, which is a fantastically incredible undertaking performed by a number of investigators. I think Keith was involved, and maybe Megan? No, neither of you, but other cadre of people. Over 7 years, right? It enrolled 700 patients, ultrasound and cardiac arrest. But that was an observational study. They were collecting data, observational. There was no intervention. There was no assignment of different arms. And so that is by definition not a trial because it's an observational study. So that's an important definition or I guess difference. So other things about important aspects about the randomized controlled trials, kind of part of the defining features aside of the control arm, the intervention and the placebo or control arm, is that you have in many cases blinding, and that's kind of also an ideal. It's not something that is part of all the RCTs. Blinding allows us, there's different types of blinding. Blinding essentially allows us to reduce even further the chance of bias. We can do no blind at all, which is the most common. Basically everybody knows the treatment, all patients know the treatment, the clinicians know the treatment, the research team knows the treatment. Single blind is when the patient does not know with the treatment. So the clinicians will know it, the researchers might know it, but the patient doesn't know what they're getting. It might be the placebo or the intervention arm. And then double blind, which would be the ideal, not the ideal, but the close to ideal, is where neither the patient nor the physicians in the clinical team know the intervention or which arm the patient is involved in or which kind of treatment the patient is receiving. And then I guess the ideal, which is almost very rare for studies, and at least in our field, is triple blind. And that is when not only the clinician doesn't know what treatment they're offering, the patient involved doesn't know what treatment they're getting, but also the researchers involved in the study don't know either. So super complicated and logistically the most kind of cumbersome. In terms of studies, since everybody mentioned one, Mike actually sent out, shared with us one that was published last year, a study by Ryan Gibbons and a group from Temple. Shout out to the Temple team. They did a pretty simple, and as it's often the case, simple but really good study with a randomized control trial design. They did a comparison of ultrasound guidance versus landmark guided for radial artery line placement. They wanted specifically to study interns, so the single center perspective, obviously, because it's interventional RCT with a convenient sample of patients coming to the emergency department who required an arterial line. When those patients were identified, their group of interest was specifically novice emergency physicians, so interns, and they defined that as under 15 attempts or 15 lines under their belt. And they randomized them, meaning that they allocated randomly the to either arm of the study to do the ART line with ultrasound guidance or with just landmark landmark guided. And as you would expect, it was a lot better with ultrasound guidance, improved first pass success and overall success. The number of outcomes that it had and the follow-up was limited as one would expect for an unfunded study, but the core of the study meets all the criteria of an RCT. RCTs in general need to be registered also by kind of a requirement, a consensus in the national trials.gov registry or platform. And that is an important marker of quality for this design, because what it provides essentially is a public demonstration that you have not altered your protocol after you design it. Once you design it, you then start enrolling patients and you put out your protocol as originally registered, and you have to stick to that or provide explanations as to why you modified it. So that's an important feature of also of the RCTs. Any time that you do one, you need to register. Not only RCTs can be registered in trials.gov, there's a separate question, but all RCTs need to be registered basically to be valid. Lots of other nuances. And again, people take, I wrote a case very recently and I put there that part of my career plan is to become a clinical trialist. So like you can say, you can see how if it's like a career plan, you can spend years literally learning about this thing and becoming sort of expert on how to do this large complicated study. So lots of nuances, and happy to discuss kind of specific questions about them, which I might or not know the answer to.
Thanks, Felipe. So again, for I think a couple more people may have joined us while we were starting. I want to encourage people to put questions into the chat that you have as we go through. We've generated some questions for our panelist experts to weigh in and talk about their experience. So we're going to jump into the questions now and really excited to hear the advice and experience that they have within ultrasound research. So the first question that we have is, how do you pick a study design? What are your logistical considerations when you've approached these issues in the past?
I can start with this one. I think first and foremost is start with what the clinical question is. And I think a lot of this research gets generated at the bedside. You're like, hey, I wonder if what the literature shows about this, and you look it up, or you do a journal club, and it prompts questions. And so, starting with the clinical question, and then you sort of a lot of the research that gets done in the ultrasound world, and we were just talking about this before the webinar started. You know, a lot of the research that gets done is the more feasible research to be done. I think there's a lot of case reports and case series that get done. That's a large share of what happens. And kind of looking through my own publications, a lot of the stuff that we've done starts off with a case series or case report. And I think that's valid. But I think depending on what the clinical question is, to answer the question well, I think you can look at some of these study types that our panelists here have talked about. I think having done a randomized controlled interventional trial with peripheral IVs with over 1,000 patients, really, it's hard. It's a logistical lift to do that kind of a study. And I think it's for people starting out in research, I think it's a lot easier to start with a prospective kind of cohort study if you have enough patients to kind of get into the study. I think you need to have the patients, and if you're going to do an ultrasound study, you need to have people to enroll them. So that will help determine what type of study design that you use as well.
I would like to just re-emphasize two really important things that Keith said. The first one is that you have to know the existing literature already. Like, you can't just come up with an idea and then just be like, I'm just going to design my own study out of nothing. You have to know what's already there and build off of it and see maybe what is remaining to ask, or where did that study fall short that I can improve upon it. And then second important thing is you got to know what resources. I mean, not all of us are going to be able to do these really complicated designs. Not all of us have research staff that's available 24 hours a day, which is, you know, the ideal way to enroll patients consecutively. So it's, you got to know your resources. You got to know what kind of studies have been done before. And then it's also, you do have to really refine your research question, because some questions cannot be answered by certain types of studies. So you have to realize, like, a retrospective study isn't going to cut it here for the causality I'm trying to establish, or something like that, where you may have to alter it just to more accurately answer the question you're asking.
Megan, do you want to add anything to that?
I mean, I'll say that definitely emphasizing the resources. I think, you know, having done the prospective observational study, it takes a lot of work. You have to have, especially an ultrasound, because it's, you know, you have to have the person there to not only enroll the patient, but actually do the ultrasound. You know, you have to do the follow-up. It's a lot of work. So, you know, making sure that you have a team, and kind of have very discreet, you know, things that you're going to collect, and be realistic as well. You know, you're not going to be able to enroll everybody 24/7. Convenient sample is the way it's going to be. And also, you know, having junior people at your side that can help with all this stuff, that gives them experience. And it also just makes these kind of studies feasible.
Yeah. But I would, go ahead. Pull it back.
No, I'm just going to, I think the points that have been made are critical. Resources, really focusing on the question. I would say that to add to that, you don't actually need to be an expert, and you won't be an expert on potentially any of these designs. And you don't need to in order to do a study with any of these designs, especially for the studies that are on the experimental part, which might be the right study, as Michael said, for your question, because you're starting with a clinical question, and it's just going to be a matter of luck to some extent what work has been done before you. So when you dive into literature and read, go to the Ultrasound Jail podcast to, you know, get fed with highly collated and expertly curated data. Once you go through that process, you're gonna have you will then have to decide what study fits better the question that you have at hand, and also the historical moment or the evolution of that particular application, or you know, whether it's diagnostic or whatever it is that you're intending to study. Depending on what kind of work has been done, some type of study might just not be ethical. Right? For instance, it just might not be ethical to randomize people to something that you think is might be interesting to study, just because you think it's interesting to study a new ultrasound technique, for instance, because there might have been enough studies such that there's no equipoise anymore. So there's no more ambiguity as to what is the right thing for patients in a clinical scenario. So that concept, I think, is from an ethical standpoint, is important, and it comes up very often when we're thinking about experimental designs. And so equipoise, basically, is there a is there clarity as to what is the best treatment or the best approach to a given situation? If the answer is no, then you can propose a study. If the answer is yes, you can propose a study. If the answer is no, if it's very clear, in this case, for instance, ultrasound guided IVs, I would argue that in 2021, ultrasound guided central lines, a study randomizing patients to non-ultrasound guided IVs would not be acceptable ethically, I believe, for say, you know, IJs. So that's another thing. But I really wanted to stress the point that you don't have to be an expert on the methodology. You are an expert clinician. You have the expertise in ultrasound. You might have identified a question that is actually very important. And even if you don't have the expertise on the design, you outsource that. You support yourself with mentors, with non-physicians that might be methodologists that you might have around. And those people might have applicable experience to guide you in the design of your study that then you inform with your clinical in ultrasound experience. So I just wanted to bring that up. By no means everybody will be able to be an expert on all of these designs. And so that it just, I think, needs to be said.
Yeah, thanks, Felipe. And thanks for everyone for your thoughts. And, you know, even to Keith's point, you know, I always think I was going to do an RCT and I was going through the IRB and they're like, oh, you need someone on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I was like, oh, can't wait to do that. So definitely those excitements and those surprises along the way definitely teach you as a researcher. So let's jump into question number two. And there's definitely a lot of overlap with the first question. So if there's not a lot to add, we'll move along. But what are some of the upsides and downsides to different study designs when you're picking? I know sort of like I just talked about, you know, the issues of being on call, but anything else that sticks out in your mind? Otherwise, we'll move along.
For me, I just want to say, going back to what I mentioned before, like if you're really trying to establish causality with something, like if you want to make the case that doing an ultrasound is actually helping the patients in some way, or, you know, whether it be shortening their length of stay or maybe their time to diagnosis or the number of differential diagnosis, all these things that we know ultrasound can do. If you're trying to make that case and establish that the ultrasound is responsible for that change, then you have to be really careful with the biases that come in from different study designs. So retrospective designs, for example, are going to be very hard to say. You just can't establish causality. You can make an association between things, but you can't say the ultrasound caused this end, you know, if we're doing like a case control study or something. So you just be careful about the different studies and what you're trying to prove. How well does it prove it?
Excellent, excellent points. So this one will be for maybe people looking to get their feet wet or haven't done a ton of research yet, but are interested in it. So what study designs would you say are best for researchers with limited experience? And again, I want to really invite our attendees to pop questions into the chat, particularly if someone says something that resonates with something that you're working on or just want to get some guidance.
I'm also seeing that there are a number of very experienced people in the list of attendees that should have probably just been part of the panel of the presenters here. So if anybody wants to just add something to this, you're absolutely welcome.
I'll start with this one as well. I think that, you know, this is something that comes up for those of us who have fellow ultrasound fellows in our shop. You know, this comes up every year. You have this finite period of time where you have someone who's fresh to research, who's interested in doing a research project, and you have to sort of and it's very tough to get things going in a very short period of time. And I think over time you sort of figure out what works and what doesn't, and you've heard the F word of research again and again, the feasibility. And so trying to find out what is going to be something that's going to be that's going to be accomplishable in your shop with your resources, with your patients, I think that is key. I think, you know, things that are good for researchers with limited experience, not being on 24-hour call to run into ultrasound, you know, collecting a patient series of cardiac amyloidosis, you're going to be on call for a long time to get your patients together. But I think looking through, you know, I think retrospective cohort studies are reasonable with those of us who have kind of archive image archiving systems and have built up a bunch of exams. I think that's one way to get started. I think collaborating with others in your institution who also have a bank of archived images, like Gavin Boodram did at UMass with the ovarian torsion case. You know, radiology has a large group of images that is something that's feasible. And I think, you know, in the times of COVID, this was a great research path for people where they didn't have to have face-to-face interaction with patients necessarily. And then prospective cohorts of common pathology, I think is key. I think you want it to be doing these studies where you have patients who come in every day with a problem. There's a clinical question to be answered, and you have a group of sonographers who can easily do this without super specialized training. I think that's the sweet spot for doing an entry level prospective project.
I would add to that, Keith, that in my experience, another important factor to consider, especially if you're a fellow, and when we say fellow, I mean, where I'm not referring to a fellow as a kind of level of competency, but rather a discrete time that you have to complete a scope of work. So that's the lens through which I think it's we should analyze what is the right study, what is the right design for me as a trainee. The first question that I ask is, how long are you going to be here? If it's a year, if it's ultrasound fellowship, it's different than if somebody's doing a master's and is going to be there for 2 or 3 years. We know that ultrasound fellowship specifically, you're kind of, you waste like 2 or 3 months studying for the boards in some cases, and then you spend the last like 3 months or 4 months looking for a job, right? Or 4 months or 5 months. So then you're left with like really a tiny space of time to actually do work. So then what I really try to push, and when I was at Penn with the awesome group there, was to encourage the fellows and also ask as faculty to look around and see what do you have to work with. So in my mind, no fellow should be starting from scratch on any project. This is my personal approach here. There is something nice about the idea that you come in and you own something and you have your own question and you do that project and you publish it. The number of people that get to do that are a minority. It is a lot more feasible, again, if you walk in and you propose a project within an area that your team has expertise, ideally, or and that can be on a faculty that already has done some research, your mentor, the division chief, or that other fellows have already done work. So ideal scenario, the fellow Michael Pratz did an amazing, you know, cross-sectional survey study and produced great data determining sort of assessing the prevalence of any, you know, important outcome and or complication related to ultrasound procedure. And then I come into fellowship and I grab that data, and with that data, I propose a case control study. And that's a perfect example of you're building upon someone else's work in your same institution. It will make things a lot easier with your IRB because you have a precedent. You can start by saying, we've done this work here. And the next step in this evolution is to do what I'm proposing. So think about what you have available. People really want to come out, have their own question, but I think it would serve the greater impact to the field if we spend more time kind of looking at what is it that we have done as a team, as an institution, and try to leverage that to to produce more impactful work. So as opposed to a case series that will be publishable on a topic that I feel really passionate about, maybe it'll be better to go with a project on something that, you know, the division chief already has worked on for 3 years, for instance, building a registry of ovarian torsions. And so the quality of work that can be produced might much more likely lead to change in impact the field, impact knowledge in a meaningful way than if the whole purpose is just to publish something.
I think that might have been a controversial statement, Felipe, that no fellow should start from scratch.
Yeah.
I think some people may see value in starting with like an IRB, going through the full project. And I see that some Rosemary put in the chat that, you know, if you have like a really concentrated group of patients that you can easily get access to, maybe you've done an appropriate sample size calculation, you know what you're doing, and you're really motivated. Understand the pitfalls and challenges. Sorry to cut you off, Meg.
No, no problem. I mean, one other approach that I've really admired that Lori Stoltz has implemented at her shop with her fellows is that she sort of has this graduated process with each of her fellows. So each fellow, you know, will start a project, will also join in on the project that was started by the year prior fellow, and then they're also completing the project that was started 3 years ago. So there's like this progression that, you know, the fellow is able to experience all the process of each stage of the project. But, you know, as you've alluded to, it's really close to impossible to be able to do all of those steps all in that 1 year. But if you have like a culture of keeping the research flowing, you know, everybody sort of benefits from the experience, but also ends up with some publications at the end. That's, you know, one strategy that I've really admired, and I think, you know, seems to work really well for them.
And here's a clarification. By no means I meant like you do a project on a topic that already has been some work. So you're going to have a new IRB probably. There is an opportunity still to do the full sort of the full depth of the work that you want as a fellow to get the experience on, you know, crafting your question, finding the right design. But you're not starting from scratch. That's the we should avoid starting from zero whenever we can.
And another way that we can collaborate is with multi-center trials. So if you're just a site for enrollment, someone else is designing the trial, and you're like, hey, I don't know much about research, but someone else designed the trial, you can just kind of follow their IRB and help them out. That's a great way to get your feet wet too, and help enroll really meaningful data towards a really big trial. So I think collaboration, and which is happening more and more in ultrasound too, is a great way that it's kind of easier to get into really powerful trials sometimes. So that's a cool idea. And also, this may also be unpopular, but I personally really enjoy case reports, especially for people who have no research experience, because I work with tons of medical students. We have medical students in ultrasound like all over the place, and they're always coming to me asking me for projects and stuff. And sometimes I think case reports are great because it just gets them familiar with the research process, like reviewing the literature for it, what's submitting and revising like. And that's a really cool thing to do with really minimal amount of work.
Thanks. Those are all excellent, excellent points. Let's move on to another question, which I think that maybe some people can draw on their experience as reviewers or mentors. What are some of the common flaws you see in different study designs that could have or should have been avoided?
I can start with this one too. I think some things have been mentioned before. I think one of the things that it pains me as a reviewer to look at an article where someone, and I know the blood, sweat, tears that goes into bringing this manuscript to the point of submitting on this manuscript submission website and getting all your images. And then you look at it and you said, this has been done 1,000 times before and there's nothing unique about this. So I think it was Mike that said, do the lit search. Make sure that what you're doing is novel. And if it's if it's a topic that's been researched before, what unique aspect of that can you look at? I think that's one thing that is and I think a lot of the clinical questions that we come up with at our shop comes from, you know, journal club that we have, journal club, or listening to Mike and his team on the Ultrasound Gel podcast, listening to the ASEP SEM Probing the Literature series. You know, you listen to these series and you're like, oh, that's really interesting. What if we did it this way? Or what if we, and so finding a way to have a novel approach to ultrasounding the gallbladder, which has been ultrasounded 1,000 times. What are you going to do? How are you going to add to the literature as opposed to just doing what's been walking over ground that's been walked over before?
I think
I just wanted to highlight really quick what was said in the comment, because that was sort of like, I think what I learned from my fellow project is just Rosemary brought up really just like nailing down in your study design, making sure the variables you choose, the things you're going to measure, the things that you're going to end up reporting on are all ironed out from the beginning. Because once you kind of go through this process, you put so much time and resources into doing the project. If you're then having to, after the fact, you know, trying to make sense of the data you have and kind of fit it into a manuscript, it really, you end up not having as good of an end product. So it's a great point.
Yeah, I think that is a good point. There are a lot of, we all have colleagues, I'm sure, who jump straight from that PICO question, which I think is the heart of all this clinical research, to writing the IRB and don't kind of flesh out the methods and what you're going to do, how are you going to measure it, what are your outcomes going to be. I think we've all been part of these projects where you have a spreadsheet of data and you're like, now what the hell am I going to do with this? So I think it you know, that is clear, mapping out, spending the time beforehand, mapping out where you're going, so that, you know, you submit your IRB, it comes back to you very quickly, you do your study. And when you have your final results, the methods section is all written already because you already thought about it beforehand. You know what your outcomes are going to be, so you have the slot in your manuscript for that. I think that's a very satisfying way to do it, rather than handing a basket of numbers to a statistician like a scraps of receipts to your accountant on April 15th, saying, "What do we do with this?"
I think to just highlight that I found that something that was very helpful for me actually was to have a template format to assess my own idea, essentially. I then actually formalized our fellows' projects with that same kind of project proposal, which I know was like slightly stressful for the fellows in the early part because they just wanted a question and kind of wanted to get started with ARB. Just like I said, in some cases, I remember one case was like, I already submitted the ARB. I was like, wait a minute, we haven't discussed this like at full length. And so having a template that has, again, the same PICOT elements, the question, design the method, like think through the methodology. I can't emphasize how many times, and this is for me has been actually the pain of writing grants. When you write a grant, you end up having to look at the details with a level of, again, kind of, with a level of detail that you normally don't do if you're not preparing something for review, essentially. So things that I think get put more lightly on an IRB proposal, unfortunately, sometimes, because they're more general. When you're submitting a grant, you need numbers, you need N calculation, you need previous data to back up your hypothesis. And then when you go through that process, you very often realize that you're missing stuff or that you don't actually know something, that you don't have information that you need to go get, or that you don't have the expertise on any of these links and you go get a new mentor or somebody to help you with that. So for me, that's been a lesson drawn from the experience of writing grants, sometimes just coming back to the drawing board and be like, okay, yeah, this is a good idea, but I'm missing a lot of stuff here. So, and there's no way to know what you don't know. And it's really good, obviously, to have a framework to organize yourself. So really encourage everybody, especially fellows, to have whatever framework you decide to use, but just write it down.
Yeah, and thanks for Rosemary for putting in the chat the strobe guidelines. I also want to direct people. Annals of Emergency Medicine has a great portion on their website, which talks about study designs and how they adhere to different study designs, such as like the STARD guidelines, which are very applicable for diagnostic imaging, and definitely want to put that out there. Because we've been going on for almost an hour and we've had some excellent chat. I want to ask one more question for the group, and that's going to be, how do you identify team members or collaborators? And then before people jump in, Dr. Francis Russell, through the ASEP Research Subcommittee, has started a Google Doc to include researchers, to put their names in, and to improve collaboration if anyone's interested in either adding their name or joining that. So I'll let the group talk about prior collaborations.
Well, I'm gonna just say something because we've already said it. You gotta know who's doing the research out there. So you got to read lots of research. If you're reading all these articles, every single first author has contact information that's publicly available. If you can get the manuscript. So shoot them an email, ask them questions. You know, there's a lot of people that love to talk about their research, and I'm sure they're already planning their next two or three studies ahead. So you, as a interested, curious researcher, is a great person to just talk to. So I would say you got to read lots of research, get, and go to conferences and listen to these webinars where you get to see faces and you know who's doing what type of research. Then you're like, hey, I have the opportunity to do this research. I'm going to go talk to that person who I know has done three articles on that topic. And then that's how things start.
I think Keith had brought this up earlier, but that's also a really great, getting involved in reviewing articles can be a great way to keep yourself up on literature and also, get your own thoughts going on new projects, designs, what seemed to work for how, you know, what when you're reviewing manuscripts, what did, wasn't really good in this one, but worked well in that one. So that's a good way to get involved, and a lot of journals are always looking for people willing to review. So, you can, submit your name and eventually you'll get asked, and it's a good way to kind of keep yourself engaged as well.
I was going to say, I second reviewing heartily. It's like study hall for study methodology and what's good and bad about study design. It really has been great. I think as far as identifying collaborators, I look at where the clinical intersections happen in the hospital. And I think right now it seems like a lot of inside the institution, there are natural collaborators. ICU is a big one for us, hospital medicine for others. I think at cases that cross disciplines, it's a good way to do that. I think outside of the hospital, it's the people at ASEP and SAEM ultrasound groups and SCUF and AIUM. I think there are great national meetings where people are, hopefully as we emerge and spend more time talking to each other outside of sessions, we can kind of pick up where we may have left off with some of this collaboration. And then I would encourage people to think outside of the House of Medicine as well. I think some of the interesting stuff that happens at intersections of emergency medicine and education, emergency medicine and public health, emergency medicine and computer science. And so I think if you have people that you can identify at your institution or in your town that are doing interesting work that you can see as applying to the ultrasound world, reach out and see, because I think that's where some unique research is going to be done.
Each paper also has, most papers on papers from studies have in the discussion or conclusions a section where the authors describe what is a future work. I go look for that every time that I'm reading an article about my field of interest. Basically, the authors already did the work of thinking what should come next. And that's a really great way to also inform the design of your study, both in terms of the design itself and also what question you're asking. Many of the great questions have already been sort of posed or brought up. And it's just a matter of they're there waiting for somebody to come, you know, do those studies.
Thanks, guys. And sorry if the link didn't work earlier. I put it in again. It was, I think, behind our firewall at our institution. And I want to invite anyone to add their names who are interested in collaborating on research at a different institution. I really want to thank our panelists tonight for their time, for the outstanding research and mentorship that they've been doing across the field. And I really want to encourage people to go out there and get their research on. So thanks so much for your time. And I think we'll sign off for the night.
Thank you very much for
thank you
hosting it, Joe.
Yeah, thanks, Jim.
Thanks a lot.
Bye, everybody.